fox hunting, bridge construction, and the history of Ganawage. Conversations about the environmental history of Montreal. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 30 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Last year, the University of Pittsburgh Press published its first book on Canadian urban environmental history, titled Metropolitan Natures, Environmental Histories of Montreal. This diverse collection of essays was edited by two leading scholars of Quebec environmental history, Stéphane Castonguay and Michel Dagenet. This episode of the podcast explores some of the environmental histories of Montreal. Montreal is one of the oldest metropolises in North America, with a history of Euro-American resettlement and urban development that spans more than four centuries. Prior to European colonization, the island of Montreal was home to the fortified Iroquoian village of Hochelaga. Needless to say, organizing a series of case studies on the environmental history of Montreal is no easy task. Castonguay and Dagenet decided to organize the collection along three broad themes: representations, infrastructures, and hinterlands. The essays in this first section, representations, focus on the changing human perceptions of Montreal and its region, beginning with the earliest observations of the island of Montreal and Mount Royal by Jacques Cartier in the 1530s. The following section on infrastructures examines socio-technical systems in the urban environment, with particular focus on water systems and roadway infrastructure. In the concluding section of the book on hinterlands, the authors explored the changing relationships between city and countryside as Montreal developed as Canada's leading metropolis. On this episode of the podcast, I spoke with two of the authors from this edited collection, Darcy Ingram and Dan Ruick. Darcy's essay in this collection, titled Horses, Hedges, and Hegemony, Fox Hunting in the Countryside, looks at the history of the sport of fox hunting on the island of Montreal. In particular, his work reveals the interconnections between city and countryside, physical landscape, and social landscape. To learn more, I spoke with Darcy about his research.
Okay, it's Darcy Ingram, and I'm in the Department of History at the University of Ottawa.
Darcy, thanks for joining us to tell us a little bit about your research on fox hunting. I guess a logical place to start to give readers a little bit of context here is to explain what the 1897 De Justice controversy was in Montreal.
Okay, well, controversy might be overstating it a little bit, but it was one of those sort of great moments in historical research when you run into a 19th century journalist that has done all of your work for you. It's that sort of world. But basically, if I can spell it out in a couple of minutes, 1897, the Quebec government passes a law making it illegal to hunt foxes between April and November.
Right.
And that's it's sort of an extension to foxes of seasonal restrictions that were typical of other game species. And it was intended to regulate hunting and trapping of foxes for furs. It kept it open during the winter months when the furs were of better quality. And the problem that arose, which gave it this sort of term, de justice, is that a warden that fall, the fall of 1897, hired by the Montreal Fish and Game Protection Club — I'll say a bit about them in a second — but he went out and arrested a couple of trappers for hunting foxes during the close season. The Montreal Fish and Game Protection Club, which he was hired by, was this sort of a long-standing Anglo-Protestant organization based in Montreal. Mm-hmm. They were established in 1859, and they were really in Quebec by the end of the century. They were the key civic association for the promotion of fish and game conservation in the province. And like many of these associations elsewhere, they hired their own guardians and they hired their own wardens. Mm-hmm. They prosecuted poachers. And in the case of this group in particular, they were really doing more in this regard than the Quebec government itself was at the time. Mm-hmm. Perhaps this is one of a number of Montreal-based sort of Anglo-Protestant associations that were dealing with animals, the Montreal Fish and Game Protection Club. And the other two really to think about were the Montreal Hunt Club, which we're talking about today in regards to fox hunting, and the other big one out there was the Canadian SPCA, which was established in the 1860s in Montreal as well. Mm-hmm. And what my journalist with the De Justice controversy noted was that there was, you know, not surprisingly, a good deal of overlap in the membership of these organizations, so that when these trappers were arrested by the warden with the Protection Club in the fall of 1897, this journalist noted that the Montreal Hunt Club, the fox hunting organization in Montreal. They were happily riding around the island of Montreal, hunting foxes. They were out there 3 days a week in broad daylight, as they'd been doing for, 70 or 80 years at that point. And he wrote about this in La Presse, a local French paper, and it sort of caused a stir in the sense that this Anglo-Protestant network was able to create these laws. It was able to enforce these laws, and at the same time, it was able simultaneously to break them, and not just to break them, but to break them in about as open a manner as they possibly could. So that was sort of the controversy itself. And what I really noted from it, or what I took away from it, first off, was that they weren't really, when I got to doing a bit of research on it, they weren't really breaking the law so much as the law. There was just absolutely no intention in the law itself of banning the elite sport of fox hunting in the first place. Mm-hmm. It was really aimed at the world of hunting and trapping for furs, and its implications for fox hunting were completely an oversight. And this was really proved a few months later when the Quebec government ended up amending the law to allow for fox hunting specifically. So when I sort of got a hold of those articles that came out in the paper and started to look at them, the issue for me that was emerging wasn't so much the controversy itself, but just how exactly we ended up with this situation in the first place. How was it that this fox hunting organization, the Montreal Hunt, was so incredibly embedded into Quebec society that it could get such an amendment passed so quickly? And sort of from by extension from there, why did these kind of complaints regarding the club's elite status and its identity, why didn't those sorts of things surface more often? And I really, the answer for me wasn't just that these folks were powerful elites in Montreal society or in Quebec or in Canada, mm-hmm. but that they were really integrated in myriad ways into that broader sort of material or cultural landscape in which they hunted. And to me, and this is where the part of the title came from for the article, it was sort of a really nice example of hegemony at work in this context. So that's where it sort of came from.
It's a fascinating example. It must have been just great moment when you stumbled across the series of articles. The journalists seem to be trying to point out hypocrisy in the law, but as you show very adequately in the paper here, there was no perception that this was hypocrisy, and in fact, the government just changes the law in effect to encode the hypocrisy into the law.
Well, yeah, in many ways, that's probably a good way of putting it, and it really, it is one of these just complete oversight. It's one of those oops moments. What did we do? We passed a law that's not going to allow us to hunt foxes. Well, we better change that. So it was really targeting targeting what were called silver foxes, those dark black foxes that were used for furs, and had no intention of targeting fox hunting at all.
So maybe we should move from here then to give listeners a bit of a sense of fox hunting in Montreal. How was it established, and in what ways were the practices of fox hunting being shaped by the natural or physical environment of the island itself?
Sure. The short story is, in Montreal, the organization, the Montreal Hunt, it really dates to about the 1820s or so. And this was the simple act of a group based in Montreal acquiring a few foxhounds. And it was really an initiative at that point of sort of a group of local capitalists in the region and military men. And the military was particularly important to it in its first few decades. And it was a pretty rough group during their first years, and English fox hunters who would come over and ride with them on occasion would criticize them for lacking the sophistication of fox hunting in England. Mm-hmm. But it shared a sort of, there was this common rough masculine identity to fox hunting wherever it was practiced, sort of a combination of elite and military identities. And again, it was characteristic in Montreal, and it was characteristic of fox hunting in England as well. And the hunt became increasingly sophisticated during the 19th century in Montreal as that Anglo-Protestant population in the city grew and that sort of elite Anglo culture established itself in Montreal, so that by the time we get to the 1880s or so, the Montreal Hunt, it's fair to say it's certainly less sophisticated than that of England, but it was about as sophisticated as it got in North America. Mm-hmm. And by that point, by the end of the century, it was well known as being the oldest established fox hunting organization in North America. And there were organizations, so sort of startup organizations across the continent, because there was a couple of spurts of fascination with fox hunting in the 1880s and again around the turn of the century in North America. These groups would look to the Montreal Hunt Club for advice. They'd look to it for support. They would buy hounds from it. The Montreal Hunt was supplying hounds to people across the continent and to clubs around there. So that's sort of how it evolved. In terms of how it affected the how the natural or the physical environment shaped fox hunting, it's quite different from England. Mm-hmm. In terms of climate, we're looking at a much shorter season. In England, they could start as early, they'd have sort of startup rounds as early as September, and the main season ran from November to May. In Montreal, they were looking at September to, you know, they might get into mid-November before the snow starts to fall. So climate-wise, it was a little different. It was also different in terms of terrain. The terrain tended to be a lot rougher. And in that context, it's probably worth remembering that England had been deforested for a long time by the time we get to the 19th century and cultivated for a long time. Montreal region, much less so. Even the island is still forested in some areas in parts of the 19th century. It's much, mm-hmm. it's much rockier. It hadn't been cleared to the same degree in terms of agricultural lands. So it had those sort of differences. There were also differences in terms of the seigneurial division of lands, the way that land tended to be divided into fairly long, narrow strips. And this, for fox hunters, could be a problem because it often meant riding across numerous properties, and if these were either fenced or there were rocks piled up to divide them, it slowed down the ride.
Right.
And in terms of how fox hunting had evolved, by the time we hit the 19th century, it had really become this sport in which the ideal was a sort of a fast ride across open country. You went as fast as you could, and anything that slowed that down affected the sport accordingly. So it had some differences in terms of the climate and the geography of the region from that of England. Yeah.
Now the sport itself involves interaction between primarily four different species: mm-hmm. the foxes, the horses, the hounds, and the humans.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the relationship between these four species of animals involved in fox hunting influence the history of the sport in Montreal?
That's a good question. And, you know, it's a funny thing because I'll say something about the foxes, but in some ways the foxes were the least important part of all of this.
That's interesting.
In a bizarre sort of way. Mm-hmm. But The greater paradox, or the pretext of fox hunting in England, and it carries over into Montreal, it was all about exterminating foxes. And these were vermin, and these were things that we needed to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't about that at all. If it was, foxes would not be around. They would have been gone centuries ago. And in Montreal, they would have been gone in the 19th century, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that much of the sort of paradox or the myth of it is well known. But in fact, it was more complex. And it was actually a sport that required a lot of management in order to maintain a healthy fox population. And this was particularly true in England. And in England, it was a long-standing practice to breed foxes and to release them. In some cases, they were kept in cages, and they were brought out for hunts. These were called bag hunts, when you'd pop a fox out, and it would take off out of a bag, and it would mm-hmm. take off, and then everyone would chase after it. In some cases, they would even catch them in England, and then just before the hounds were about to pounce on them, and then they would put them back in the bag and take them back to the kennel and use them again. So it was a bizarre sort of context in England. And again, Montreal was less sophisticated, but it tended to follow the same pattern. And by mid-century, the club was keeping foxes at its kennels. It was purchasing foxes from farmers, and it was releasing them on the island in order to stock the island with foxes. Mm. It would have men called earth stoppers who knew where all of the foxes' holes or all of the earths were, and they would find them and locate them and keep track of them that way. By the time we get to the 1880s, we have this bizarre situation in which foxes are actually being shipped by train to Montreal from as far away as places like London and Hamilton in Ontario. And they actually had a merchant supplying them with foxes out of southern Ontario during the 1880s, and they were purchasing them that way and having them sent to Montreal by train. So it was quite a sort of a management feat to keep the island stocked with foxes, and this was well developed by the 1880s.
And the club itself maintained stable facilities in the city for their horses.
They did, yes. The other animals that were a big part of this, of course, were the horses and the hounds. Mm-hmm. And that's one of these areas, and you may have run into it in some of your work, Sean, but mm-hmm. one of the fascinating things I find with the Montreal Hunt is the whole world, or the whole relationship of it, to animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And again, the horses, the hounds, and in particular the horses, were really important to this world. And the people that were participating in the sport, first off, they spent a fortune on them. They spent a lot of money on horses, and for a number of reasons. The whole world of horse ownership and horsemanship, it was a mark of elite identity. It was a mark of military bearing, an affiliation with elite custom and tradition and land ownership and power and all of those sorts of things. But the men who were involved in this, there were also men who bred horses, bred cattle. They bred dogs in some cases. A few of them had investments, big investments in Canada's cattle ranching industry, or they were involved in the transportation industry with horses. Some of Canada's most prominent veterinarians were members of the Montreal Hunt Club, people like Charles McEachern and Duncan McEachern. There's an equivalent fellow out of Toronto called Andrew Smith, another prominent veterinarian. And I think all of this really helps explain the relationship of the Hunt Club to Canada's 19th century animal welfare movement. And this is true in Britain as well. The Canadian Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was established in 1869 in Montreal, and it's the first such organization in Canada, and it was absolutely dominated by members of the Montreal Hunt. One of the masters of the hunt in the 1870s, Andrew Allen, from the shipping family, his brother was Hugh Allen, he was a vice president of the CSPCA for years. I mean, they're intricately connected to that world, and it doesn't speak so much to a contradiction in regards to their hunting of foxes, but it speaks to this tremendous interest they had during the 19th century in horses and in horse rearing and in horse breeding. And to some degree, it was also a class issue. These were people of a certain class in society who were angered by the abuse of horses in Montreal streets and this sort of thing, so by the carting industry and this sort of thing. So, these animals were at least as important as the fox, if not more so.
So maybe that's a good point then to think about the position of fox hunting in Montreal society. Can you speak a little bit about the class dimensions of the practice and even the ethnic dimensions of the practice?
Yeah, again, this is, I mentioned before the Hunt Club and the CSPCA and the Fish and Game Protection Club. These were all coming out of, by and large, and it's a bit of a generalization, but by and large, they were coming out of Montreal's Anglo-Protestant society. They weren't all necessarily the same in terms of things like respectability and, sort of moral reform and that genteel world. The fox hunters weren't as much a part of that world. They were the men who were interested in the military, a fairly conservative crowd, sort of a rough masculine sort of identity that they cultivated. But nevertheless, this is the world that they moved in, and there were some pretty intricate networks there. In terms of the fox hunting club itself and the fox hunters, by the 1880s, it had really become one of the key social institutions in the city, so that it was really a marker of elite social life, going out to the hunt club balls that they would have or going out to the meets and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was the kind of association that's probably worth remembering. These were the folks who entertained visiting royalty or the governor's general, this sort of thing, when they were in Canada. And it wasn't like, the governor general or the whatever visiting royalty. It wasn't sort of the event where, they were shaking hands at a church fundraiser or something like that. This is where they went to have fun. This is where they went to socialize and have a good time. So the fox hunting society or culture, or the Montreal Hunt Club, really, really fit into Montreal in that sort of a sense.
Mm-hmm. Were there any French-Canadian fox hunting organizations?
There were by the end of the century, and this is one of the funny things about this world, and we might speak about it in a few minutes, but I characterize the relationship of this, sort of bastion of Anglo-Protestant culture in Montreal as being somewhat, the French-Canadian component of that society, somewhat ambivalent in regards to how they understood it, because on the one hand, there were instances in which hounds were shot or foxes were routed off of people's land or farmers would put up barbed wire and this sort of thing. But by and large, that wasn't the norm. And this was also a fairly entertaining sort of a thing to see all of these men riding around in the countryside in their full uniforms and everything. So there was also considerable support for it in terms of it being a form of entertainment, in terms of it having a presence on the island. Yeah, in terms of, I'm not sure where we were going there with with exactly how that fit into there. In terms of the sort of broader class dimensions of things, one of the interesting things about this in terms of negotiating the place of the hunt on the island of Montreal, the hunt club went to considerable effort to do this in terms of not just negotiating a place with the farmers when they were actually riding, but they would hold exhibitions and they would hold fairs and they would sponsor all sorts of activities like this. They would organize races, they would put up prizes, they would judge competitions. So they went a long ways towards actually integrating themselves into that farming community or that farming society in order that they could have a place in it and they could ride across these lands and do what they did. And in order to keep a lot of French-Canadian farmers and other farmers in general from exterminating foxes on their own, because, of course, they were supplying the foxes and stocking the island with them, and that's the last thing they wanted to have happening.
And this gets, I think, at the core of your argument in this essay here. Can you speak a little bit more about the way in which city-countryside relations mediated fox hunting as a sport in Montreal in the 19th century?
Yeah, and again, I'd come back to that term negotiation, and this is one of the striking things for me in doing the research. It really was a process of negotiation, and the hunt was very conscious of the need, and this comes through in all of their minutes and their archives, very conscious of their need to maintain good relations with local farmers. And they were presented, by and large, again, they presented very varied opinions. Some of them were hostile to it to some degree. But what surprised me is overall there were no big problems out there. And if we compare that to what went on in Ireland, for example, in Ireland by the last half of the century, things were ugly, and fox hunters were more or less driven out of Ireland. They were subject to threats and violence and arson, and barns and stables were being burned down. Actually, the Montreal Hunt Club, they got a pack of hounds, which really helped establish them in the 1880s. They got their pack of hounds from Ireland from a fox hunter who was abandoning the sport because of all the violence that they were subjected to during this time in Ireland. They made a point of settling their disputes fairly quickly with local farmers, and I think that helped them a lot because fox hunting, of course, produced a lot of damage in terms of fences knocked down and, in some cases, animals scared off and this sort of thing. They paid damages out to people very quickly through what was called a poultry fund. It was sort of something they would reach into, and they'd always have a bit of money to pay for these sorts of damages. And again, that rural populace really enjoyed seeing them in the countryside to a large degree, to the point that while we had at the end of the century this question of due justice coming up in La Presse and this criticism of this paradox, at the same time, and I think you asked me this a few minutes ago, but at the same time, right around the turn of the century, there were two French fox hunting clubs formed in Quebec. So there was a real fascination with this culture as well.
And just as a Quebec historian, what do you think this says about the colonial relationship between English and French in the 19th century?
Well, that's one of the fascinating areas here where this gets tricky. I mean, there are so many stereotypes out there, and we're obviously playing with a couple of the big ones here, the Anglo-Protestant versus the Francophone Catholic world. And in fact, their understandings of each other were fairly complex and multifaceted. I mean, at some level, what we're seeing here with fox hunting is this. It really is. It's the spectacle of power. Here are these people riding through the countryside on horseback in their scarlet uniforms. It just screams British identity. It screams a sort of stereotype in terms of English power and a particular kind of power associated with custom and tradition. To ride around the Montreal countryside, to ride across farmers' fields hunting foxes, and that sort of action implies that someone is somehow above the laws of property and above the laws of ownership and above the laws of trespass. To do that sort of thing was really to make a statement about one's British identity, about the British identity of this largely French and Catholic part of British North America or Canada. It was ultimately a statement of power, and yet the lines weren't so clearly drawn. And again, for many people, French and English alike, were fascinated with this world and fascinated with the sense of power and the sense of British identity with which it was associated.
Well, I mean, it's an extraordinary case study here and a great example of how looking at the relationships between humans and animals in history in some ways reveals some interesting facts about the relationships, the social relations between people.
No, this is certainly true. And it was to think about it in class terms, it was a really expensive and it was a really demanding sport. And that was one of the things I was struck by, and it's one of the reasons why it really was confined to an elite part of society. You had to be wealthy. You also had to have a lot of free time to be able to do this. And I've found myself over the past few years working on sport, sort of unwittingly in a number of contexts, working on hunting and fishing and conservation. I've recently been doing some research on cycling and bicycling in the Montreal area, and then this fox hunting one is yet another one. So I find myself in some cases working on sport, but in all of these cases I'm finding myself working on sports that demand a considerable amount of infrastructure mm-hmm. and a considerable amount of sort of institutional capacity or institutional framework. So that, you know, calling something like fox hunting a sport, it really is an understatement. And these folks who were really involved in it, from September to November, 3 days a week, basically all day, they were out there. That was what they did. It was expensive for the horses, for the hounds. I mean, they had foxes. They kept employees. There was a huntsman that was paid full time. They had a couple of people who were called whippers in who would ride with them. They had earth stoppers who would go around and sort of manage the foxes themselves and their earths or where they lived. They kept a kennel. You mentioned the stables before. Mm-hmm. They kept stables. They kept a clubhouse. They kept a house for the huntsmen. They kept horses and then their own horses and the club's horses that they kept specifically for employees. So there's a lot of money, a lot of infrastructure wrapped up in this sort of thing, yeah.
Well, it's an extraordinary case study in one of several excellent environmental histories of Montreal that readers can find in Metropolitan Natures. Darcy, thanks so much for letting us know a little bit more about your work.
No problem, Sean. It's good to talk about it. Thanks a lot.
Just as fox hunting tied city and countryside on the island of Montreal, the city of Montreal's urban development also had consequences for the surrounding plain on the other side of the St. Lawrence River. Directly across from Lachine, on the south bank of the river, is the home of the Ganawage Mohawk peoples. This unusual Indian reserve has a long and complicated history that has been very much tied to the urban development of the city of Montreal. Dan Ruick spoke with me about his research on Ganawage and his contribution to this collection, titled When Bridges Become Barriers, Montreal and Ganawage Mohawk Territory.
I'm Daniel Ruick, and I'm a PhD candidate at McGill University.
Thanks for joining us, Dan. We're talking about your contribution to Metropolitan Nature's Environmental Histories of Montreal. And you've published a chapter in this collection called When Bridges Become Barriers, Montreal and Ganawage Mohawk Territory. Why don't you start off by telling listeners a little bit about where Ganawage is, what Ganawage is?
It's a Mohawk community that's about 10 or 12 kilometers from downtown Montreal. It's on Montreal's south shore, so it's today it's surrounded by Montreal suburbs. It's near Chateauguay and Delson. But when it was founded in the 17th century, it was quite a distance from Montreal.
So Montrealers today would probably be most familiar with driving through or over this territory.
That's right. Many, many people have the experience of driving through Ganawage or buying cigarettes in Ganawage. But very few Montrealers know anything about Ganawage or have ever visited the actual village.
Now, this gets at a little bit about what you're trying to do in this chapter, which is integrating the history of Ganawage into the urban history of Montreal itself, which, as you say, hasn't really been done very much in the past. Why is it, do you think, that the history of this territory south of the island of Montreal has been treated somewhat separately from the city itself?
I don't know exactly why, but I guess I can muse a little on some reasons. One of them is that this is a First Nations community near or even surrounded by suburbs of one of Canada's largest cities. And this is not necessarily unique in Canada or in North America or anywhere, but there has been very little written about it. People don't people aren't quite sure, I don't think, what to do with a native community that's basically surrounded by an urban area.
Now, the story that you tell in this chapter begins with talking about bridges, which, as you describe it, obviously, in this chapter, that a bridge becomes a barrier, the CPR bridge that crosses the river and has one of its landings at Ganawage. How did the CPR bridge become a barrier? What do you mean by this?
Well, I guess the story goes that this was the second bridge across the St. Lawrence that was built in the 1880s, so 1886, 1887. And of course, bridges are built to connect things. In this case, it was built to allow the railroad that crosses Canada to actually cross the St. Lawrence River, which at that point it hadn't been able to. And so in that sense, it was connective. But for the people of Ganawage, it was also extremely disruptive because for them it meant land loss, it meant cultural change, it meant many more strangers in their village, it meant expropriation of territory, pollution that they hadn't experienced before. There were a lot of fires that were started in Ganawage by sparks that came from locomotives. These are some things that everyone, not just First Nations, experienced with railroads coming through. but in this case, I think the reason why I wrote about it as a barrier is because I used the bridge as a symbol in my essay of all the development that's happened in Ganawage since then and before then that is related to Montreal industrialization. For example, the seaway that cuts through Ganawage and took disconnected Ganawage from the St. Lawrence River, which is the reason why the village was located there, and disrupted village life. It essentially changed people's perception of themselves and their connection to the environment.
Now, for a time, the CPR bridge, when it was built, actually became a conduit for Ganawage laborers to get to Lachine, as you describe. So, in a certain sense, it brought Montreal and Ganawage closer together, but only for a limited time?
Yeah, that's right, because initially, Mohawks were allowed to use the bridge to walk across it. The schedules weren't reliable enough that people could use the train to go across. They never knew when the train was going to come. And also it was expensive to use the train, and these were not very highly paid laborers who were working in factories in Lachine. And so they were able to walk across. It gave them more opportunities for wage labor and for things like berry picking and fruit picking, which a lot of women were involved with from Ganawage. But then there was a time, there were several incidents, one of which I describe in the chapter, where people were stopped by the railroad company from crossing the bridge. And as you can imagine, this was out of the control of Mohawks, and it meant that many of them lost their jobs or were forced to get across the river and stay there and be separated from their family, pay another rent in another apartment, which many weren't able to do.
And this is just one of many ironies in the story that you tell in this chapter about the impact of industrialization in Montreal on Ganawage and the community, but also the ways in which Ganawage were a part of that industrial economy, but perhaps a marginal part of that industrial economy.
Yeah, I don't get the sense from my study that Mohawks from Ganawage were necessarily against industrialization. In fact, Mohawks have a strong tradition of being iron workers and steel workers building skyscrapers and bridges. So there's what they were against and what Mohawks are still against today is when people interfere with their culture, with their territory, with their politics, their ability to govern themselves. And this bridge is a good example of that, of the bridge being built regardless of what Mohawks thought.
And this takes us precisely to the main subject of your work, which is about property and land, the distribution of land and the redistribution of land. So can you tell listeners a little bit about how Ganawage Mohawks allocated property and resources on the reserve prior to the construction of the CPR bridge or the first surveys of the reserve?
Yeah, many, there was a perception until fairly recently, and the perception may still be there, that Ganawage Mohawks were less traditional, perhaps, than some of their southern Iroquois or Haudenosaunee brethren in upstate New York and in Ontario. But in fact, in terms of land use, Ganawage Mohawks were extremely conservative, one could say, in the sense that they maintained unique and distinct land use traditions for long into the 19th century until the 1880s, like you said. And some of the characteristics of this way of using land were, just to give you some examples, there were no formal surveys done in Ganawage, so there weren't any maps of where boundaries between different people's lots lay. But people, of course, knew. People understand where boundaries are. It's not like people in Ganawage didn't have a sense of private property. But their sense of private property was very different from what most of us think of today as private property. So, for example, there, if there's a piece of land that's not being used by anybody, that would be considered available. And this was traditional way of claiming land would be to go and clear some land and then to cultivate it and to grow crops. The traditional crops are corn, beans, and squash among all the Iroquoian people. And Ganawage Mohawks were doing that. This way of claiming land well into the 19th century. And the other interesting thing about this is that then when someone would stop using a piece of land, if they let it lie fallow for usually about 3 years, that meant that it was available for someone else. Mm-hmm. In terms of distinct, I could tell you a few more distinctive characteristics, but I don't want to belabor the point.
Now, particular resources on that land, however, were treated differently than in the private property system outside the boundaries of the reserve.
That's right. So the prime example here is wood, and according to Ganawage tradition, wood on someone's property, if it was still a tree, was not owned by the person who owned that land, and anybody from that community could go and cut down a tree on someone's property. And this was not the case for maples. Maples that were used for sugar production were considered used. Mm-hmm. And so they were owned by the person who owned the land.
So this is interesting. It's species-specific.
It's species-specific. Maple was a special tree. Maple sugar production has a long history among Haudenosaunee people. They were doing it long before Europeans arrived.
Now, how clear to Canadian authorities, let's say in the Department of Indian Affairs, or even corporate authorities with the CPR, how clear was this land system in Ganawage from the perspective of outsiders, let's say?
I get the sense that they didn't understand it at all, and I don't know if that's because they didn't want to understand it. Maybe there is a sense that, I do get the sense that Indian agents who were the federal government's representatives at Ganawage did know some of the details of this, but that doesn't mean that they thought it was legitimate. And of course, bureaucrats in Ottawa, I don't think they understood it at all. But in either case, whether they understood it or not, it wasn't respected, and there was never a sense, when dealing with wood problems or conflicts between different Ganawage Mohawks or between anybody on these resource issues, I never got the sense that the federal government or their agents felt that empowering Ganawage to enforce its own rules was the solution. Their approach was always to enforce Canadian rules in Ganawage.
And it seems like from the history that you tell here that the Ganawage system of property and natural resource distribution comes into conflict at the moment in which either the Canadian government or, in this case, a corporate railway interest needs that land.
That's right. One of the best examples of this is the fact that a man named Dawes was hired as the person to arbitrate wood conflicts in the years starting about 8 years before the bridge was built. And it just so happened that Dawes was also an important industrialist in Lachine, and he was also one of the I think the president of the board of the Dominion Bridge Company, which eventually built this bridge. And maybe someone in those years leading up to it may not have recognized why this person was taking such an interest in Ganawage, but it's obvious that both the Department of Indian Affairs and capitalist interests and the CPR were very interested in trying to settle or regularize. They would use the word regularize land transactions and land ownership at Ganawage in preparation for the railroad to come through.
Right, because then it becomes clear who you compensate.
Yes, that's right. Because otherwise, imagine trying to figure out whose land it is from an Ottawa bureaucrat's perspective or from a railroad perspective, when there's no map to show whose land is whose, and all you have to rely on people's word and on witnesses, and obviously there are going to be different opinions on whose land is whose, especially when there's a lot of money involved in compensation. But of course, the other thing to keep in mind is that land, by its very nature, on Indian reserves was worth less, which made it more attractive for railroads to bisect.
Now, at a certain point, the Canadian government imposes, to a certain extent, a land survey on Ganawage to regularize the distribution of land, to allocate owners, and to parcel it so that it could be redistributed or confiscated and changed hands in terms of compensation to owners. But there's some critique in the chapter here on the part of the federal government that the common access to natural resources was somehow inefficient. But you argue to a certain extent that common access to resources, or you suggest, somehow challenges Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons thesis, that this doesn't play out at Ganawage, that Ganawage don't compete with one another and strip land entirely of its forest cover.
Well, I think Indian Affairs was right in diagnosing this. I'll say it's something controversial right now. I think they were right in calling this, in treating it as a tragedy of the commons in the 1870s, but that's only after they had caused this. So, of course, there was no tragedy of the commons in Ganawage for 200 years previous to this, and the resources had been allocated efficiently and in a relatively communitarian way in Ganawage, and it was only after Confederation with the Indian Act and with the more aggressive policies of the Department of Indian Affairs that that this resource chaos, in a sense, was caused because of lack of enforcement. Chiefs weren't able to enforce their own rules because the Department of Indian Affairs undermined them. The Department of Indian Affairs wasn't able to enforce its own rules because they didn't have anybody on the ground to do the enforcing. And so you had both Mohawks, seeing this situation where there was a lot of wood being cut and saying, there's a lot of wood being cut, maybe I should get some too. And then you'd also have non-Mohawks outside the community coming in at night and cutting wood, and there was no one there to stop them either.
And this is another avenue in which Ganawage is integrated into the industrial growth of Montreal. A lot of this wood was being sold as fuel wood?
Yes, this was the importance of this wood was because everyone heated their homes with wood at this time. And in a cold climate, this is essential. And Mohawks had always had access to this free source of energy from their own territory. And this was being threatened at this time, and it was a really, really important issue, recognized by everyone as a really, really important issue. And then you mentioned, of course, the Wallbank Survey, which was this attempt by Indian Affairs to impose its own way of solving this problem, which was to send in a land surveyor and to define the boundaries. So he drew on a map where everyone's lot went and where everyone's boundaries went and how much everyone's land was worth and who had the right to each piece. And of course, this was a very expensive, very long, drawn out process, and of course filled with Euro-Canadian values. This land surveyor wasn't Mohawk, and the rules and the logic that he was using wasn't Mohawk either. And the actual idea was not just to define the borders, but to create a completely new set of lots, so that every lot would be rectangular, because the previous lots had been very irregular shaped. Now, every head of household, which was a man, would usually a man. There were a few widows that would have been eligible, would have received 30 acres. And the idea behind this was that each Mohawk person would in this way be enfranchised, which meant that they would lose their Indian status and would become a Canadian citizen with voting rights. And it was hoped also that all of them would become farmers, because this was also considered part of being a civilized person at the time, and a way for an Indian to become a non-Indian. And that was part of the law at that time, that if you wanted to stop being an Indian, and they called that being enfranchised, that you needed to work the land in a Euro-Canadian way, in a way that was recognized by people as farming.
Mm-hmm. And so the Wallbank survey becomes this tool of assimilation.
Exactly.
Now, the survey was one way in which Ganawage comes to be geographically represented, but you talk about maps of the reserve, often depicting it as forested. Can you explain a little bit why that was the case and what the meaning of that was?
Yeah, and I think that goes back to my last thought, which was that the Mohawk way of farming wasn't recognized by Europeans as a legitimate way of farming. Often it was small scale and small plots of land. Mm-hmm. It didn't involve planting things in rows. It didn't involve plows. It was done with hoes and with small tools. It was done by women. For the most part, women and often older men or children would be involved in this. So it went against the European idea of having a plow and having a man do it and having the woman be in the house. And so I think that the way that it's depicted on maps, Ganawage through the 19th century was depicted as sometimes as a blank space on a map surrounded by farms. Sometimes it was depicted as forest, as you mentioned. It was called Indian woodlands in some cases. It's shown on the map. Sometimes it is shown as Indian cultivated land or something like that, but it's still shown as something other. And I think that's because of a particular way that non-Mohawks saw that land. They weren't able to see it as farming.
So in the end here, do you see the transformation of land, or at least some of the changes in the imagination of how land is distributed at Ganawage, as being interconnected with its relationship to the city?
Yeah, I mean, one of the important things that you mentioned as well, too, that you picked up from my chapter, was that one of the important factors is the growth of the city in this. And one of the important pressure points, we could call it, is that everywhere around Montreal, wood was in short supply. And so everywhere around Ganawage, there was also a wood shortage. So relatively speaking, Ganawage had more wood. So it does make sense that people from the outside would come there to steal wood. So that's one way that Ganawage is experiencing very similar things from as other areas around Montreal, and in a different way.
Well, Dan, thanks very much for telling us a little bit about your work.
Thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Networking Canadian History and Environment. This is our final episode before the summer break, but we'll be back with new episodes starting this September. To keep up with current work in the field of environmental history this summer, I encourage listeners to download our new iOS app, which works on iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. You can get the app at niche-canada.org/envhist. That's ENVHIST. If you don't use an iOS device, you can keep up with the latest environmental history blogs, podcasts, news, and events at envhist.com. ENVHIST.com. This episode was made by Darcy Ingram, Daniel Ruick, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can always follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, you can contact me through my website, seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the NICHE website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in September with another episode of Nature's Past.